Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nancy Lesson of the group Military Families Speak Out, who takes a critical look at the recommendations made by the Iraq Study Group, led by former Republican Secretary of State James Baker and retired Democratic Congressman Lee Hamilton. A report on a dispute between the Pentagon and National Guard and Reserve soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan over these veterans' eligibility for GI Bill education benefits. And Tim Carpenter, director of Progressive Democrats of America, who describes the national campaign advocating that Congress initiate impeachment proceedings against President George W. Bush. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On Sunday, December 10th, one-time Chilean dictator General Augusto Pinochet died at a Santiago military hospital at the age of 91 of complications following a heart attack 1 week earlier. Pinochet took power on September 11, 1973, in a bloody coup supported by the United States and ruled Chile with an iron fist for 17 years. His government reportedly murdered over 3,000 people, more than 1,000 were disappeared, tens of thousands were tortured, and hundreds of thousands were exiled. Augusto Pinochet was arrested in London in 1998 while he was being treated there at a clinic for back surgery. He was held for 17 months under house arrest in an 8-bedroom house in Surrey, prompted by two Spanish judges seeking extradition and charging him with torturing and murdering Spanish citizens in Chile. He was also charged with the murder of two bodyguards of his predecessor, Salvador Allende. 2 years before his death, legal action against Pinochet was launched in Chile, but claiming mild dementia and physical limitations, he avoided trial for the hundreds of cases filed against him. Pinochet's reputation was further eroded when documents revealed that the general had stashed as much as $17 million of state funds in secret overseas accounts. Despite heading a repressive regime, Pinochet retained some loyal supporters, some of whom clashed with the dictator's opponents as they celebrated his death in the streets of Santiago and elsewhere. Pinochet requested to be cremated, knowing full well the possibility of his grave being desecrated if he opted for burial. Bolivia's first indigenous president, Evo Morales, has pushed through a massive land reform initiative over the fierce opposition of conservative lawmakers and large landowners. Already, Morales has given 8,500 square miles of government land to poor, landless peasants. The new reform plan will redistribute 77,000 square miles of underused land. The focus is on sparsely populated areas owned by a few wealthy families, primarily of European descent. The land reform bill passed the Senate on a 15-0 vote, despite a walkout of 12 conservative lawmakers organized to block the measure. A potential deadlock was averted when three opposition senators agreed to back the land reform package. However, large landowners in Bolivia's eastern lowlands have threatened to use force to block government land redistribution efforts. Before the vote, Morales spoke to about 10,000 supporters in a plaza in La Paz and said, "It is not possible, my friends, to have so much land in so few hands and so many hands without land." Economist Muhammad Yunus, winner of the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize, pioneered the microcredit movement with a simple humanitarian impulse in the mid-1970s. Frustrated with the power of moneylenders over the poor in his native Bangladesh, he lent $27 to 42 villagers. He was repaid in full. Through the Grameen Bank, which Yunus founded, millions of women in South Asia got access to microcredit, small loans that women used to create small enterprises and escape poverty. Currently, the Grameen Bank lends $800 million to the poor in Bangladesh, with an average loan of $130 and nearly all the credit going to women. The level of poverty in Bangladesh has fallen 9% over the last 5 years, but remains at a high level of 40%. In his December 10th acceptance speech, Yunus told the Nobel Committee in Oslo, "Poverty is a threat to peace. I believe in putting resources into improving the lives of poor people." He also criticized unrestrained free market capitalism as unfair to poor nations like Bangladesh. However, others want to turn microfinance groups into an arm of the financial services industry. Profit-oriented microfinance has recently gotten backing from Citigroup. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Denise Manzari. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
When the Iraq Study Group unveiled their set of 79 recommendations to confront what the panel labeled a grave and deteriorating situation in Iraq, President Bush gave the bipartisan committee's prescriptions a lukewarm reception. Mr. Bush now intends to shop around for new ideas on how to proceed with his Iraq war strategy and report to the American people on his new direction in the new year. Among the study group's key recommendations are the gradual withdrawal of most U.S. combat troops by early 2008, initiate a regional dialogue to include Iran and Syria, and applying pressure to the government of Iraqi Prime Minister al-Maliki to reduce sectarian violence or be subject to cutbacks in U.S. support. Iraq's President Jalal Talabani leveled criticism at the report, saying that it is not fair, is not just, and it contains some very dangerous articles which undermine the sovereignty of Iraq and the Constitution. Some conservative Republicans were more blunt in their criticism of the report, describing it as defeatist. As the death toll in Iraq climbs ever higher among the civilian population and U.S. soldiers, the debate in Washington goes on with little input from peace groups and veterans organizations who continue to call for a rapid withdrawal of U.S. troops and an end to the U.S. occupation. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Military Families Speak Out co-founder Nancy Lesson, who discusses the Iraq Study Group recommendations and the pressure she feels must be applied to the incoming Democratic Congress to end the war.
There are 79 recommendations. There are, you know, several main ones that jumped out at us. None of them are going to end the U.S. military occupation of Iraq. I mean, there was a whole piece about diplomatic efforts with other countries in the region. And, you know, what we feel is that no attempt at diplomacy is really going to be able to succeed without the recognition that the real problem in Iraq is the U.S. occupation. And as long as the U.S. is militarily occupying Iraq, it's going to be really difficult for diplomatic efforts because they're tainted by the U.S. occupying. And we think U.S. has little or no credibility in the region because of the invasion of Iraq, you know, and reaching out our hand to others to discuss while we continue to militarily occupy the country is not going to build trust and communication. There is another whole piece that sort of suggests that the real problem in Iraq is the Iraqi government that has to take more responsibility. So there's a lot of tough talk, you know, as if the Iraqis are slackers here. And again, we say the Iraqi government is not the problem. The problem is the U.S. occupation. And as long as the U.S. is occupying, you know, the chaos and violence will not only continue, but they're going to escalate. And then finally, the other big point is that the study group report calls for this gradual withdrawal of some combat troops. And what we believe very strongly is that partial withdrawal of some troops that isn't part of a total concerted effort to safely and quickly remove all U.S. troops from Iraq is just something that is actually going to continue the occupation. And it's also going to leave those who remain, those troops who remain, at greater risk. And so we believe very strongly the safest thing for our troops, the best thing for our country, and the best thing for the people of Iraq is to get U.S. troops out of Iraq as quickly as possible.
I think there's a general recognition in the country, if not the political class, that the Iraq War, it was a huge mistake. It was founded on lies and manipulation, and that as the end game is played out here in a face-saving manner to disguise the military loss the U.S. is suffering there, that there will be many people killed. And how do you think people who are opposed to this war, including your organization and many others and individuals who are listening, how can they be effective in stopping this war sooner rather than later?
The one thing I'll say is I don't think it's ever been a politician who's ended a war. It's been a social movement. And our job is to build the greatest, most powerful social movement that will then result in ending the war. I'm not sure that we can see very many options here. I think most of us in military families speak out, don't think that George Bush is going to get up and end the war. So our focus really is on Congress. And what we would like to see is continual pressure on Congress to do what they can do, which is use the power of the purse. And there's going to be another spending bill coming up sometime February, March, April, that's going to ask for another, maybe $130 billion for the war to carry it through the next year and a half. And we would like to see the largest movement across the country of people that are saying to Congress, you can't do that. No more funding for the war.
Before you go, I do want to ask you a little bit about the protest movement. And there are two major marches on Washington that are now scheduled. The Coalition United for Peace and Justice is scheduling a march on Washington on January 27th. And another one is scheduled by the Answer Coalition on March 17th. There's been an unfortunate split in the protest movement. And I'm wondering, how important are these days of protest in the nation's capital?
I mean, we think everything is really important. There is not some magic, doing one thing and the war will end. So I think the large demonstrations, I know Military Families Speak Out is a member organization of United for Peace and Justice, and we will be having military families coming in from across the country to participate in that. The majority of people in this country are saying the war is wrong, but the majority of people in this country aren't out in the streets, and the majority of people in this country at this point are actually not doing very much to end the war. So we hope to really strategize with the rest of the movement that's opposing the war in Iraq to think about how to get people more active, how to move from opposition to action.
That was Nancy Lesson of the group Military Families Speak Out. Call the group at area code 617-983-0710 or visit their website at www.mfso.org. Some American soldiers returning from duty in Iraq or Afghanistan are now hoping to start or continue their college education, are running into a roadblock when they are told that they're no longer eligible for GI Bill education benefits. But a law was passed in the early 1990s extending National Guard and Reserve soldiers' benefits eligibility for a period of time after leaving the service. The Veterans Administration and the Department of Defense disagree on whether the 400,000 service members who have served in these two wars are eligible for up to $300 a month in benefits to pursue an education. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus files this report. She begins by interviewing Jack Mordenti, Executive Director of the National Association of Veterans Program Administrators and Director of Veterans Affairs at Southern Connecticut State University, about his efforts to help returning vets secure these benefits.
Last May, I became aware of the fact that the Department of Defense was telling war-activated Guard and Reservists that if they left paid drill status, in other words, finished their time in the Guard and Reserve, that they lost their GI Bill. And in fact, it's not true. There was a law passed around 9/11 that changed the Guard and Reservists being able to continue to use their GI Bill. The VA and the DOD attorneys had to sign off on this law because of the way things are processed. And the VA's made it very clear to me that they let the DOD understand what this meant, and they said they did. Well, now they're saying that they disagree with the VA's interpretation of the law. So it's an incredible bind here, because the VA is paying claims to Guard and Reservists who apply for their GI Bill after they get out. On the other hand, the DOD is telling them they're not eligible for this benefit. So it's only if the Guard or Reservist happens to find out, coming to Southern, you know, through a network that I'm involved with. Otherwise, they don't know.
Now, I'm certainly not an expert in this, but I thought after World War II and people came out of the military, I thought it was then that they began using the benefits of the GI Bill.
No, that's the active duty GI Bill. The active duty GI Bill is for any veteran who's served 2 or 3 years or more. When they come off active duty, they have 10 years to use their GI Bill. The Guard and Reserve GI Bill didn't go into effect till 1985. It was part of the new volunteer program, obviously, to encourage people to enlist. That's a separate GI Bill. And the laws for that one is, at first it doesn't pay as much. When the Guard Reserve GI Bill was implemented in 85, you had to enlist for 6 years in the Guard Reserve, and you got this GI Bill. Now, at that time, that GI Bill was only good as long as you stayed in the Guard and Reserve. But then, after 9/11, they introduced a second GI Bill for Guard and Reserves to pay them more money because of their deployments. And with the implementation of that second GI Bill, it removed that that regulation that said you lost your GI Bill if you left the Guard and Reserve. And so that's what it is, where it is right now. And I have a student at Southern that's probably the best example. He had two activations, got out of the Guard and Reserves, called me up and said, Jack, I'm out of the Guard and Reserves. I can finally finish my degree. I'm not going to get deployed anymore. And now this is 2 years ago. And at the time, we were told what the law was, is that you lost it. And when I told him, he was quite angry. Well, when I found this out in May, I put him in for the benefits. He got $3,000 retroactive.
Lieutenant Colonel Steve Beller of the Army National Guard writes the Guard policies to implement Army regulations. He says, unlike the VA, the Department of Defense interprets the law to restrict eligibility for benefits to those still on drill status. He says the general counsels of the VA and the DOD issued opposite opinions.
The two general counsels met, I believe, in October. Both of them maintained their own opinion. Neither one will issue an official opinion, so until OMB rules on the issue, we will continue briefing as our attorneys have stated that those benefits terminate upon leaving Selected Reserve. That's because they're not paying into it. It's something that the government gives them in exchange for their service. Once they stop their service, that benefit is gone.
Rick Scavetta served in the regular Army and then the Reserves for a total of 15 years. He was called up to serve in Afghanistan for 15 months and left the military last February. He says he was told in his exit briefing that if he left, he would not be eligible for Reserve GI benefits.
The most important thing that a veteran can have when they come back to civilian world, you know, civilian lifestyle, is access to accurate information to make those life decisions that we're trying to do coming in through a unique transition. And education is a great outlet for someone who's coming back and trying to stay focused on something. Imagine if someone told you, hey, you know, we promised you these benefits if you served our country, and you held up your end of the bargain for 6 years in the reserve, two of it deployed overseas or whatever, for example. You'd expect that you have those education benefits and be able to start school. And it's frustrating to think that probably because of a retention issue within Guard and Reserve units, that they would tell inaccurate information to returning veterans to keep up their numbers so they're still deployable for future activations.
Jack Mordenti said his organization is trying to get the word out nationally. He says student vets make up more than 20% of the just under 400,000 members of the Guard and Reserve who have served in Iraq or Afghanistan since 2001. So far, the VA says it's paid about 3,400 people under this provision.
I can imagine how many around this country are probably eligible for some denomination of money. And these are war-activated Guard and Reservists who sacrificed. And now they're being told that they're not eligible for a benefit that they are eligible for. It's appalling.
This report was produced by Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus. For more information on GI Bill benefits, visit the National Association of Veterans Program Administrators website at www.navpa.org. Thank you. A coalition of groups advocating the impeachment of President George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney came together on November 11th in Philadelphia, the birthplace of the U.S. Constitution, to launch their grassroots national movement. Groups participating in this first gathering included Gold Star Families for Peace, Democrats.com, Veterans for Peace, Code Pink, Progressive Democrats of America, Now, and the After Downing Street Coalition. The new group, Impeach for Change, set two primary goals, gathering 1 million petition signatures in support of impeachment and forming impeachment committees in all 435 congressional districts to lobby their representatives. The mobilization of citizens working to remove Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney from office comes despite statements from incoming Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and soon-to-be chair of the House Judiciary Committee John Conyers that impeachment was off the table. A pre-election Newsweek poll released on October 21st confirmed what several other surveys have found, that a majority of citizens support the impeachment of the president. As her final defiant act in Congress, outgoing Georgia Democratic Representative Cynthia McKinney introduced impeachment legislation, which her party's leadership declared was dead on arrival. In their first nationwide action, the Impeachment Coalition organized 75 events across the U.S. on Human Rights Day, December 10th. Their activities included meetings, vigils, teach-ins, and mock funerals for the Constitution. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Tim Carpenter, National Director of Progressive Democrats of America, who describes the objectives of this grassroots impeachment campaign.
We began in earnest after DowningStreet.org was founded in May of 2005, as many of the listeners remember, when it became clear during Blair's election of the secret memos and minutes that took place that documented clearly the president's intent to take us into war. And we began, as I said back then, which led to, in December of last year, with Congressman Conyers introducing his bill 635 for select committee to oversee and look at possibility of impeachment and censure of the president. And with the majority of Democrats now taking over in Washington, not a progressive majority, but a majority, and we were really excited to continue to turn up the heat. While many of the politicians in Washington want impeachment to, quote-unquote, be taken off the table, the grassroots is alive, and 75 events across the country took place. Dozens, hundreds of activists came together to launch a petition drive, a grassroots petition drive, to get 1 million signatures to take to Washington, and to organize our community in all 435 congressional districts to let the old members who are returning to Washington and the new members to know that this movement is alive, growing, and resonating across the country.
Tim, as you said just a moment ago, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and John Conyers, the incoming chair of the Judiciary Committee in the House of Representatives, have both stated unequivocally that impeachment is off the table. This has devastated many activists who were hoping this election would allow for a chance to aggressively investigate the Bush administration, bring to light wrongdoing, and if warranted, begin the impeachment proceedings. Tell us what you think the motivation of the House leadership is to say that impeachment is off the table.
Well, as we've been articulating from the first meetings that we had in regards to this whole post-election strategy, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker, really wants to succeed in the first 100 hours and move legislation forward that will be successful in passing, whether it be the raising of the minimum wage or addressing the question of health insurance and how to move those questions forward. We certainly support that, but we also believe, as I said earlier, that we need to remind them that this movement is alive and growing. We need an inside-outside strategy. Gather the signatures on the petition, and then we need to visit our congressional members. Between now and January 3rd, when congressional members are back home, we're really hopeful, as I said, we're organizing in all 435 congressional districts, that folks will go meet with their congressional members to let them know while impeachment is off the table, we're going to continue to organize, to mobilize, to gather 1 million signatures, and we'll deliver those to Washington beginning on January 3rd and 4th, the first 48 hours when the new Congress is sworn in. We're encouraging citizens to join with us in Washington, D.C., David Swanson is after Downing Street. Cindy Sheehan, founder of Gold Star Families, will be leading that effort in Congress to articulate this vision of impeachment and the need for oversight and investigation. We feel confident if we can continue to really organize in the streets and go to Washington with this message of oversight and investigation, when those procedures move forward, just as folks are disheartened right now currently that it's been taken off the table, we feel they'll be encouraged when they see the congressional members begin those subcommittee and committee hearings. So the first thing we're asking folks to do is get out to Washington on the 3rd and 4th, be a part of that effort. You can visit after Downing Street for all the information regarding those efforts on January 3rd and 4th. And then finally, on January 26th, 27th, 28th, and 29th, there'll be national mobilization on that Saturday in Washington, D.C. It'll be the first citizens action following the election. We hope to put hundreds of thousands of folks in the streets. And then again, that following Monday, we're going back to the halls of Congress. We really want to encourage folks to focus on Congressman Henry Waxman, who's going to have the committee assignment on government reform. He's made it very clear that war profiteering is going to be one of the first issues he moves on. He's going to be subpoenaing and doing all kinds of work, whether it be on Bechtel, Halliburton. We think that'll be the first real breakthrough for us. So we hope that while folks may be discouraged in what they're hearing out of Washington, is to double their efforts, be part of the growing movement, and hold these folks accountable. And we think we'll succeed ultimately. We feel by March and April that impeachment will be very much on the table.
You know, I've talked with Elizabeth Holtzman on this program as well, and she was part of Congress in the congressional panel that initiated impeachment proceedings against then Richard Nixon in the Watergate era, and she knows the process pretty thoroughly. And she did say that despite all the protestations of the House leadership that impeachment's off the table, there is kind of an environment that will develop that will be supportive of impeachment if there is aggressive investigation, and that some of these issues come to the fore, the skeletons come out of the closet, there will be a groundswell of support to hold the president accountable. And the only way you can do that in our Constitution is through impeachment.
And I think that Congresswoman Liz Holtzman is one of the best spokespersons we have currently right now. As you said, she was there. She knows how Congress operates. And she's one of the strongest advocates. She kicked off the series of the town hall meetings with Cindy Sheehan, and she's out there crisscrossing the country, as is John Nichols, as is Gore Vidal. There's some outstanding spokespersons that are really helping to mobilize as part of this effort. And I think that after Downing Street's doing some heavy lifting, and I think the role of Progressive Democrats of America is to ensure that we continue inside our party to move these issues forward. And I think you'll see in January, February, March, at county central committees, state central committees, these issues will move forward, resolutions will pass. And we will hold these folks accountable. And while, again, some folks are a little pessimistic right now, we're very optimistic. We've come a long way since December of last year in this movement. And if you could have been with us this past weekend at many of these events across the country, you see a real resolve in people to continue to move this issue forward.
That was Tim Carpenter, National Director of Progressive Democrats of America. For more information on the work of the Impeachment Coalition, visit the AfterDowningStreet.org website. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.